Hi, I'm Ivan Semenek. Welcome to The Universe in Mind. Imagine it's a beautiful spring morning, just after sunrise, and you're standing in the heart of Venice, in the Piazza San Marco. Today, you might find a few birds there, and maybe some early bird tourists looking for their first espresso of the day. But 400 years ago, this place was a major center of world trade and commerce, which means it was full of people trying to get an edge up. People like Galileo Galilei. It's pretty hard to talk about our exploration of the universe without mentioning Galileo. In the spring of 1610, he ushered in the modern science of astronomy when he published his observations with a new kind of scientific instrument, something that would eventually be called the telescope. But if you met Galileo just before this turning point in his life, well, you'd be hard-pressed to see any sign of future fame.
Well, there wasn't a lot visible going on in his life.
That's Mario Biagioli. He's an historian of science at Harvard University, and he's written extensively about Galileo and his times. In this episode of our show, Mario Biagioli is introducing us to the Galileo we don't often encounter in the history books, a Galileo who's thinking less about changing the universe and more about making ends meet.
His finances were quite tight, and sometimes, you know, very tight, to the point that he was sued by his brother-in-law because he had not paid the dowry for the sister, blah, blah, blah. As a result of being the firstborn, his father died relatively early, so Galileo was in charge of paying the dowries of his sisters. So clearly, it's not that Galileo was greedy, but he actually could use some extra cash.
At that time, Galileo was teaching at the university in Padua, near Venice, and so his solution to his financial stress was to open his doors to his students. Literally, open his doors.
Basically, he was running a boarding house, so he had a number of students living with him, which was quite typical at the time. That is, kind of university towns where students would go to the university, but it would also take courses with various professors or private tutors. For instance, a lot of aristocrats sometimes they would skip the university classes altogether and just work with private tutors. There is some evidence that Galileo probably was renting additional homes in Padua and then, rent them out, sublet them to students. So, and these were students who would live with him, and they would also be his private pupils.
So you might wonder, what was Galileo teaching all of those pupils? Was it astronomy, mathematics? Well, in a way. But mainly, it was what you might call Warcraft 101.
So a lot of these were kind of aristocrats who wanted to, get a sense of military engineering. So, and he would teach mostly fortification, and then he would teach them how to use the military and geometrical compass that was also, it was kind of a wide-ranging computing device, but it was particularly geared toward ballistics.
Galileo's geometric and military compass was a kind of battlefield pocket calculator, and it reveals Galileo's own calculations for getting ahead. He devised the instrument himself, then built it with his own hands. He arranged for a craftsman to make many more, and in a masterstroke of marketing, he wrote a manual to sell along with it.
This was like a 60-page booklet, which basically he just sold locally to students who came to him to learn how to use the instruments. And that's pretty much the only thing he had ever published until then. And he was, in his early 40s.
The portrait Mario Biagioli paints is not that of Galileo, the champion of scientific thinking, but Galileo, the middle-aged academic who has to hustle to keep his head above water. That may be appropriate for Venice, but all the while, Galileo is carefully building up an alter ego, a new and improved Galileo, not a lowly professor in Padua, but a mathematician in the court of the Grand Duke of Florence.
So he was basically trying to keep his feet on in two places. So in Padua, he was more like, if you want, an applied mathematician, a teacher, an instrument maker, you know, and instead in Florence he was kind of working on his patronage skills. So, for instance, Galileo would go back to Florence pretty much every summer. He would often teach mathematics to the Prince Cosimo, who then became Grand Duke.
In fact, Galileo was actively cultivating Cosimo and his famous family, the Medici of Florence, doing everything he could to curry their favor, everything including acting as their personal shopper.
At one point, he negotiated the purchase of a large lodestone for the Medici in Venice. And then he wrote some description, some sort of basically an impresa in the Renaissance, like a motto centered on the lodestone, praising the power of the Medici, you know, the power of the Medici acting as the lodestone that attracts its subjects to it naturally. So the Florentines were not just, you know, were not oppressed by the Medici, but actually they were naturally attracted to Medici, to the Medici as their natural rulers, right?
Today it's a bit surprising to think of Galileo this way, as someone so preoccupied with selling himself. But as much as Galileo tried to woo the Medici, it looks like things really weren't going to work out for him in the end, unless something big happened. And as it turned out, something did.
So, Galileo basically heard sometime, I believe, in early 1609 about the telescope. And then we know from Dutch documents that in October 1608, Hans Lipperhey in Middelburg filed for a patent for a telescope. And then other people in Middelburg also filed competing applications.
Galileo knew of the telescope, but he hadn't yet got his hands on one. To do that, he would need his inside connections back in Venice. It was the moment that would change his life.
An artisan came through Venice with one telescope. I think it was a French or you know, kind of Northern European artisan, and actually applied for a reward. So it's not clear whether they applied for a reward or a patent with the Venetian Senate. And at this point, the technical advisor for the Senate was Paolo Sarpi, who was Galileo's friend. So probably Galileo either saw this telescope or he got a pretty good description from Paolo Sarpi. And at this point, he started, producing, you know, his own.
Clearly, it seems like he got quite busy, doing something with the telescope. What do you think was going on? Do you think he sensed right away that this is something that could be an advantage for him?
Well, first of all, it's not clear what kind of use Galileo thought the telescope could have, you know, at the time. Certainly, the way he presented it to the Venetian Senate right after, as soon as he had a decent one, he offered it basically as a military device. He, in fact, you know, we have descriptions of Galileo walking up the St. Mark's Tower with the various senators, showing them, you know, the fact that the telescope could spot ships, you know, further out at sea than an unaided eye. And that, you know, the senators recognized, you know, these very practical military potentials. It looks like the Dutch inventor, Hans Lipperhey, did exactly the same, you know, in his patent, his patent application, because the patent was actually denied. He asked for a patent or some sort of pension, some kind of reward. And the telescope was clearly presented as a military device. So most likely, this is a kind of guesswork, but my guess would be that Galileo thought of the telescope as a very interesting device that he could produce and sell or something, the way that he was producing the military and geometrical compass, and the way he had applied for a patent for a water pump in 1594.
So, as you say, Galileo wasn't the first to conceive of the telescope in this way. Was there something different about the way he approached the telescope?
The telescopes that were coming down to northern Italy from the Netherlands, from France, and so on, it looks like they had a four power range. And that's pretty much, it seems that that's what you could produce if you used lenses that you could pick up from a glassmaker. Right? So Galileo figured out that you actually needed a weaker objective lens, so something with a longer focal length. And then instead, a more powerful eyepiece, you know, a concave eyepiece. So that seems to be what he figured out. And in fact, there is something that has come up recently. In one of the letters from this period, Galileo basically writes down a shopping list. You know, he's in Padua, but he's going to Venice to buy things, supplies. And he lists that he's going to buy a small cannonball. Probably not really a cannonball, but it's like a colubrina, like, you know, a small. And probably that was he used to grind the eyepiece. Okay, so basically he figured out how to make more powerful telescopes. He clearly was good with his hands, having already produced other instruments before. So he came up from power 4 to 9, 20, and then he claims that he had a 30 power instrument within roughly 6-8 months.
Now, how did things take a turn from the military application of the telescope to astronomy and all of the big discoveries that were soon to follow? What triggered Galileo to point the telescope to the sky?
So there is a little piece of interesting evidence from the Netherlands. That is, once Hans Lippershey applied for the telescope and there was again a public demonstration that is remarkably close to the one that we find described in Venice. You know, people went up on a tower with the various dignitaries, you know, showing off the telescope. So right after this, we have a report that actually people grab the telescope and start observing stars and planets. So it doesn't look like, you know, obviously once you have a device like the telescope, it doesn't take much to point it up to the sky after you have played around observing, you know, bell towers and inscriptions on buildings far away, blah, blah, blah. So I don't think that it takes much to basically get the idea that you can use it for astronomy. And so probably that's also what, you know, what Galileo did. So at that point, he started observing first the moon and then Jupiter. And that's when things got interesting.
How did they get interesting? I mean, there were satellites around Jupiter, but why would that change things for Galileo so dramatically?
So the interesting thing is that there is a letter from January 1610 where he writes to a friend about these discoveries. And there he mentions that he has been, so he describes what he has seen, you know, about what he has detected about the surface of the moon. And then he says that he has been conducting these observations of Jupiter. And that he has noticed these fixed stars. So basically what happens is that the first time he observes Jupiter, he sees these bright dots, and he thinks that they are fixed stars. So he goes back the next evening. You know, there might have been some cloudy night. But anyway, he goes one evening after another, and he notices that these dots, these bright dots, change position. But he still thinks that they are fixed stars and that it's Jupiter that is moving in relation to them. Then he checks the astronomical tables, because, I mean, he had assumed that, you know, that Jupiter was retrogressing, and the tables don't say that. So after, you know, a few evenings, and because he mapped the position of these dots, he saw that the pattern of change in their position could not be related to, you know, they were not fixed stars, but they were, you know, satellites. So in a sense, the discovery was the result of sequential observation over a number of evenings, and that's what he presents in the Sidereus Nuncius, where he has about 40, you know, the positions of the satellites over about 40 evenings.
According to Mario Biagioli, it's these astronomical observations that signal a major change for the telescope and for Galileo's career. As a military invention, perhaps the telescope might improve Galileo's situation in Venice, but as a tool of celestial discovery, it could be much more, possibly enough to give Galileo exactly what he wanted most, the attention of the Medici.
Way. So first of all, he, you know, kind of dedicated this discovery to the Medici. He called the satellites of Jupiter collectively as the Medician stars, and that was, you know, a key in, you know, move in his attempt to move back to Florence as the philosopher and mathematician of the Grand Duke. So he presented the satellites of Jupiter as Medician stars. In the introduction, in the dedication of the book, he says that basically these are just the most enduring monuments that the Medici or anybody else will ever, you know, have. These are not, you know, stone statues that eventually will degrade. They're not like, you know, the Pyramid of Egypt. These are going to stay well preserved for a very, very, very long time.
But in order to give this most incredible of gifts, Galileo has to make sure the Medici have a sense of how incredible it really is. And he does this by playing a very careful game.
In a sense, it looks like he kind of threw a little bait to the Medici. As soon as he started discovering interesting things, he told them that he was coming up with something very, very interesting, but he didn't quite tell them what it was. Like, for instance, he tells them that he has discovered these new stars that nobody has ever seen before, but he doesn't say that they are orbiting Jupiter, which is interesting because he thinks that had he divulged that information, maybe somebody in Florence could have actually printed it, right? Yeah. So in a sense, he passes information to the Medici about his discoveries and tries basically to kind of turn them on, but he's fairly stingy with the information. He gives them a little carrot, but he tries to make sure that they want to hear more, which, you know, he then, you know, supplies more information. But you can see that he quite carefully, you know, kind of graduates the information about his discovery as he proceeds with his negotiations about a possible move to Florence.
So then does the publication of the book, yes, Sidereus Nuncius, which makes this all public, yes, is that then the consequence of all those negotiations, or how is the timing of the book applied?
In a sense, the first 3 months of 1610 are extremely, you know, action packed for him. So first he sends this kind of feeler to the Medici to see if they would be interested. So first he lets them know about the discovery. He sees that the Medici are excited. Then he responds, "Well, you know, I would be very glad to dedicate this to you." He gets a very enthusiastic response. So he starts, you know, talking to the Secretary of State about possibility of, you know, going back to Florence. And at the same time, he conducts all the observations that he's going to publish in the Sidereus Nuncius. So actually, as he talks to the Medici, saying that I've discovered this, he actually keeps observing. And he delivers bits and pieces of the book at different times to the printer, probably both because, you know, he's writing as he goes along with the observations, but also probably not to give the whole manuscript to the printer because then somebody could see it. So in a sense, right, there is also a kind of a secrecy-related element to the way he delivered the manuscript to the printer. So the book comes out with the dedication of the satellites of Jupiter to the Medici. At this point, though, he still does not have an offer from the Medici. He has secured their consent to the dedication, and he has started contacts leading to a position in Florence. But, you know, the actual contract comes in, I think, July 1610.
And is this all being done through intermediaries? Is it, you know, because he's known to them as a tutor of the prince, but obviously not at a station where he could just be talking to the Grand Duke?
Everything is done through actually everything. Most of this negotiation is done through Belisario Vinta, who is the Secretary of State. And it's interesting because, in a sense, there is no direct contact, of course, between the Grand Duke and Galileo. And that's, of course, how any kind of negotiation took place. But it could also be that it was also perhaps a way for the Medici to distance themselves a little bit from, you know, in a sense, they were also trying not to take responsibility for Galileo's claim. So in a sense, you know, they could say, well, look, our Secretary of State accepted the dedication of the stars. That doesn't mean that, you know, we believe. So there are all sorts of, you know, quite cautious moves. And you can see that the Medici, although they are very excited, they are not completely sold on the product.
They're not so sure, right.
Now, that's very interesting because it's clear what Galileo is going to get out of this if he can. He's trying to get himself back to Florence to be part of the court of the Medici, big promotion or change
in social standing. His salary was pretty much doubled.
So what would the Grand Duke get out of this? I mean, why would they have been even interested in this kind of curiosity about the night sky?
I mean, in a sense, this was a fairly new way to, you know, package discovery. And actually, I cannot think of another example in which, you know, an astronomer kind of really presented a discovery as something close to a work of art. I mean, the references to the monuments, I think, should be taken, you know, literally. Technically, Galileo wrote a book that was going to be read by the people who bought the book as being about discoveries. But to the Medici, you know, in a sense, what the Medici were receiving was a very special kind of artwork. And again, I'm not saying that the notion of artwork captures what Galileo is doing. I'm just saying that Galileo is doing something new that is not exactly what we would say a scientific discovery today. So it was neither a scientific discovery nor a straight artwork. It was some sort of hybrid between the two.
You've been listening to Mario Biagioli, professor of the history of science at Harvard University and author of Galileo Courtier, The Practice of Science in the Culture of Absolutism. Of course, we know how this part of the story ends. Galileo's strategy ultimately worked. Thanks to his discoveries with a telescope, he did manage to get the job in Florence he was yearning for in the court of the Grand Duke. To find out what happened next, listen to part two of our special podcast on Galileo. And this ends part one of an all-Galileo edition of The Universe in Mind. Remember, you can subscribe to our show on iTunes. The Universe in Mind is sponsored by the Dunlap Institute for Astronomy and Astrophysics and produced here at the University of Toronto. Johannes Hearn is our associate producer. Kathy Parrott provides online support. Our cover art is by Bettina Forget, and the sounds of Venice were recorded by Norman Hajar, author of Venice Blog. I'm Ivan Semenek. Join us again soon for more excursions into the realm of astronomical ideas. And in the meantime, don't forget to keep the universe in mind.